So I want you to picture something for me.
Okay, I'm ready.
You are standing right in the middle of a sun-drenched park in Huntington Beach, California.
Oh, nice.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can just feel the warmth radiating off the grass. And everywhere you look, there is this constant, chaotic, just joyful motion.
Like a dog park.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You've got golden retrievers sprinting after tennis balls, French bulldogs trotting along, kind of setting this totally uneven pace for their owners.
Yeah, they do that.
And then off in the shade, you see a couple of greyhounds just resting under the palm trees. It's this completely vibrant, living ecosystem built entirely around the relationship between dogs and their people.
And that energy, that specific, really highly structured bond playing out on the grass, I mean, that's the exact phenomenon we are dissecting today.
It is. We are doing a deep dive into this fascinating stack of notes from the artist Jairo Duke.
Right. And he's analyzing his own watercolor painting, titled CG.
Yes, CG. It's actually the 21st watercolor from his book, Trastio Pintura Artistica.
Which is based on a reference photo taken just up the coast, right? In Whittier.
Yep, Whittier, back in April of 2026. And you can actually see the piece in a virtual exhibition right now at artcoloragua.com.
Highly recommend checking it out. Yeah.
But what makes these notes so incredibly compelling is that Duke is crossing extreme, and I mean almost punishing mathematical precision with these really profound conceptual reflections on how our pets basically reorganize our entire lives.
Yeah, because watercolor as a medium, I mean, it's already this high stakes puzzle.
Oh, absolutely.
You miscalculate one brush stroke or you add like literally a single drop of water too many.
And it's ruined.
Yeah. The portrait just turns into this dead, opaque disaster.
Right. So to understand how he actually pulls this off, we have to start at the physical foundation, which is the paper itself.
The literal dattle ground.
Exactly. And Duke is very, very specific about the parameters he's working within here.
He is. So he's painting on a 15 by 22 inch sheet of Arches paper using these Daniel Smith pigments. But the critical detail, the really important part, is the paper's weight and texture.
Okay, break that down for us.
So it is a 640 gram cold pressed rough grain surface.
640 grams. That is basically rigid cardboard.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because if you take standard sketching paper and flood it with watercolor, it instantly warps, right? It buckles into a wrinkled mess.
A total pool of water, yeah.
So this sheer thickness means Duke is subjecting the paper to immense water punishment.
Exactly. The paper has to be structurally unyielding because of the sheer volume of liquid involved. But the rough grain texture, that's even more important than the thickness.
Really? How so?
Well, you can't conceptualize the surface as a flat, smooth canvas where paint just glides like on an ice skating rink.
Okay.
Microscopically, this paper is like a jagged mountain range. It is a chaotic topography of tiny valleys, craters, and peaks. So that rough grain acts as a system of thousands of unpredictable microscopic reservoirs.
So the paint and the water are just constantly getting trapped in those craters. So
Exactly.
you can't just forcefully drag a brush across it and expect a uniform line, right? You have to like negotiate with that terrain.
You do. The artist is forced to collaborate with the physical reality of the cellulose. He can't just dominate it.
That makes sense.
And that volatile terrain is really the staging ground for the core technical mystery of CG, because the subject is a dog with this deeply vibrant black coat.
Right, which sounds simple until you think about the medium.
Exactly. In watercolor, you fundamentally rely on the white of the raw paper for highlights. You can't just paint white reflections over a dark background.
Right, it's an intense mathematical paradox.
Yeah.
How do you paint a vibrantly black, energetic dog when the medium is absolutely unforgiving?
Because if you just lay down a dense silhouette of black pigment,
You kill the
you
painting.
kill it. It becomes a flat, light-absorbing void. It destroys the illusion of life immediately.
So how does he do it? How do you construct vibrant blacks mathematically?
Well, Duke's notes outline this completely mind-bending process. The very first step, the first layer, uses absolutely zero black paint.
Wait, no black paint at all.
None. He begins with a base of complementaries.
Okay, I have to push back on this. Using pure, highly concentrated complementary colors, say like a deep crimson red and an emerald green. If you mix those, you don't get a shiny black coat.
Right.
You get mud. You get an ugly, heavy, brownish sludge.
Yeah.
So how does that create a shiny black coat?
See, if this were an opaque medium, like acrylic or oil, you're totally right. You would just get sludge.
Yeah.
But the physics of watercolor changes the equation entirely. Watercolor acts as successive sheets of microscopically thin, tinted glass.
Okay.
You aren't covering the paper, you're filtering the light.
So wait, the ambient light in the room actually has to travel through that transparent pigment layer.
Yes.
Hit the white cellulose of the paper underneath and bounce back out to the viewer's eye.
That is the exact mechanism. The white paper is essentially the internal light bulb for the entire painting.
That's wild.
So by layering these transparent complementary colors, like applying a sheer wash of crimson, letting it dry completely, and then pulling a sheer wash of emerald over it, the light still passes through and bounces back.
So the colors are optically mixing in the viewer's eye rather than physically mixing into mud on a palette.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because of that, the human eye perceives this vibrating, immense darkness. Duke perfectly refers to these as Negros Respirados.
Breathe blacks,
yeah.
The dark areas literally have oxygen and light moving through them.
Yep.
If he used standard carbon black, it would be like throwing a heavy wool blanket over a lamp.
Yeah.
The bounce is just gone.
Completely gone. So once that breathing base is established, his notes detail a second layer, which he calls derived neutrals.
Derived neutrals.
Yeah, and these act as thermal balancers for the piece.
Okay, thermal balancer sounds incredibly technical. What is that actually doing mechanically on the paper?
Well, colors carry visual temperature, right? Like warm reds visually pull forward toward the viewer,
sure.
While cool blues recede into the background. So when you have an intense clash of primary or secondary complementaries in that first layer, the visual temperature is super chaotic.
It's just too much vibration.
Right. So derived neutrals are these complex, muted tones, often tertiary colors, that bridge those extremes.
I see.
They cool down a shadow that's maybe too aggressive, or warm up a mid-tone, creating depth and cohesion without killing that vibration.
Without turning the area opaque.
Exactly. Which sets the stage for the third layer. And Duke describes this as the technical peak of the entire artwork.
Sculpting the volume.
Yes. He has to actually give this dog muscles, ribs, and three-dimensional weight.
While still preserving the absolute raw white of the paper for the brightest sun, glints on the fur.
Exactly. He is defining the physical geometry of the animal entirely through shadow manipulation. And because of those microscopic valleys in the paper we talked about, he is having to calculate fluid dynamics in his head in real time.
Wait, how so? Like the moisture control?
Yeah, the moisture. The artist has to calculate the exact ratio of water in the brush bristles versus the residual moisture already sitting in the paper's craters.
Oh, because if the brush is too wet.
Capillary action will suck the tinted water straight into the dry white highlight, and it's ruined forever.
And if the brush is too dry?
It just scrapes across the peaks of the rough grain, leaving a really harsh, unnatural line. Duke has to possess near precognition of how the water will behave before the brush even touches the cellulose.
See, this reveals a massive contradiction at the heart of the piece.
How so?
Well, we are describing this agonizingly slow, surgically precise mathematical process, right? Calculating capillary action and optical light physics. But when you actually look at the painting of Sigi, it doesn't look rigid at all. The dog has its front paws crossed mid-jump. The mouth is open in this massive canine smile.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a completely spontaneous fraction of a second.
And that's the paradox of the medium. That extreme, grueling calculation is literally the only avenue to achieve that feeling of absolute, uncontained spontaneity.
It's very much like high-end wildlife photography.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like you see a breathtaking shot of a falcon, perfectly framed, right? Catching a fish precisely as the sunlight hits the water. And it feels like this miraculous, lucky snapshot.
Like they just happened to be there.
Exactly. But in reality, the photographer had to sit camouflaged in a bush for 3 straight weeks, calculating wind speed and light angles, waiting for the mathematically perfect alignment. The spontaneity is thoroughly engineered.
That's a great way to put it. Because the spontaneity of Sigi's pose was heavily constructed too. Duke didn't just paint a random snapshot. He hunted for a reference image with a very specific psychological weight.
The head tilt.
Yes. The key detail is the head tilt. Sigi is not staring off into the middle distance. The dog is looking back over its shoulder, actively interpellating the viewer.
Making active eye contact.
Exactly. Duke's notes describe this as displaying an incipient awareness of the bond.
Incipient awareness of the bond.
Yeah. Sigi is not just some passive object waiting to be observed. The animal is a subject fully engaged and aware of the emotional machinery they are a part of.
Which shifts the conversation from just technical execution to a much broader philosophical question, really.
Right.
Because an artist dedicating this level of mathematical rigor to a portrait of a dog, I mean, that says something profound about how we currently view these animals.
It really highlights a brutal historical paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Think about it. Historically, particularly in rural environments or past centuries, an animal's role in the human sphere was strictly utilitarian.
Right. They were tools. They hunted. They guarded the property.
Exactly. Or, you know, in aristocratic circles, they might have been mere status symbols, just living property to project wealth.
They slept outside. They had jobs.
Right. But today, there's been this massive shift. The modern urban pet has evolved into an entirely different entity. Duke defines the contemporary pet as a catalyst of well-being.
A catalyst of well-being. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
They've really become these highly structured central family members.
Absolutely.
I mean, we literally reconfigure our human routines around their biological needs. People change their remote work schedules to accommodate walking times.
Yeah.
We buy specific vehicles just because a dog crate fits better in the back. Mm. We choose our vacation rentals based solely on pet policies.
It's true. The dog is no longer a peripheral accessory. It is the effective nucleus around which the human family orbits.
Yeah, the family often defines its own identity through its relationship to the animal.
Exactly. And if the pet is this powerful nucleus, this active agent that transforms the spaces and lives of its owners, we have to ask how that physical and emotional alteration is actually captured in the artwork.
Well, this brings us to a fascinating section of Duke's notes, his own transparent self-critique.
Which is so rare.
It is. It's rare to see an artist so openly dissect the flaws in their own finished masterpiece.
What does he point out?
He zeroes in on the fourth layer of the painting, the final character details, the tiny hairs, the specific shine on the snout.
Okay.
He admits that in this layer, he lacked a slight containment.
Ah, I see. In the context of watercolor physics, overworking those final details is super dangerous.
Why is that?
Well, when you try to force microscopic rigid control onto layers that were built on fluid dynamics and transparent light bounces, you start to clog the tinted glass.
Yeah.
You risk literally suffocating the veneration of those earlier happy accidents, those breathed blacks. The painting just loses a fraction of its oxygen.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
But his second critique, I think, creates a much larger conceptual friction.
Which one is that?
It's regarding the background. You have CG painted with this immense kinetic energy leaping through the air, right?
Right.
But the green grass behind the dog is painted with loose, abstract, gestural strokes. It functions as a generic outdoor space, but it's completely static.
Oh, and Duke concedes that, right? That the landscape lacks integration with the subject.
Yeah. Because think about it. When a heavy, energetic dog jumps, the physical world reacts violently.
Oh, for sure.
The grass flattens, dirt is kicked up, the air currents shift. If the background remains static and undisturbed, it creates a conceptual short circuit.
It really does.
The dog looks like a digital sticker pasted onto an inert screen.
Yeah, and that contradicts the entire thesis of the painting. Because if the animal is an active agent that reconfigures its emotional ecosystem, the physical landscape around it cannot be passive decor.
It should be swept up in the same tidal wave of energy.
Exactly. However, despite that friction, Duke argues, and I agree, that the painting still succeeds beautifully.
Why?
Because it is emotionally explicit without being anecdotal.
Hmm. What does he mean by that?
Well, painting domestic animals is a conceptual minefield. It is dangerously easy to slide into superficial sentimentality.
Oh, like the cheap, disposable cuteness of a gas station greeting card.
Yes. The kind of thing that evokes a fleeting awe and is instantly forgotten.
Right.
You avoid that by treating the subject with uncompromising technical dignity.
Like using extreme mathematics.
Exactly. By applying this severe mathematical process, calculating fluid dynamics to construct breathing shadows, the artist forces the viewer to take the subject seriously. Sigi isn't just a cartoon. This animal has immense existential weight.
Which leads to Duke's final, ultimate conclusion about the artwork. The painting is not merely a portrait of a dog named Sigi.
Right.
What is it then?
It is a physical trace. It is the residual moment of an emotional earthquake that has already reorganized a family.
Wow.
The artwork isn't the event itself. It is the tangible evidence that the emotional ecosystem of this household has completely mutated because of this animal's presence.
The residual trace of an emotional earthquake. That concept extends so far beyond watercolor pigment on cellulose.
It really does.
It actually reframes how we navigate our own physical spaces.
Absolutely.
And I want you, listening right now, to think about the architecture of your own daily life. Imagine if an artist came in tomorrow to paint only your physical space, without the people or the pets in it.
Just the space.
Just the space. Or imagine if someone tracked your physical movements through your house over the course of an entire year. Every step you took, mapped out in a continuous line.
That would be wild to see.
Right. If they looked at that geometry, they wouldn't see the efficient pathing of a human living space. They would see a map composed entirely of strange detours.
Definitely.
They would see you inexplicably stepping over a specific spot on the rug every morning. They would see a wide, unnatural arc in your padding around the living room to avoid waking a sleeping animal.
Or a pocket of dead space in the kitchen where the water bowl sits.
Exactly, dictating where you can and cannot stand. Our physical geometry, our literal movement through time and space, is constantly warped by the invisible gravity of these animals.
Even long after they move, the invisible architecture of how we structure our lives around them remains.
Right. Future archaeologists wouldn't just see a domestic dwelling. They would see a space engineered around a completely different species. The visible footprints, the scratches on the sofa, the rearranged furniture, they prove how our affective ecosystem is structured around those we care for.
It's the breathed blacks of our everyday routines, the unseen forces giving volume and shape to our lives.
Exactly. So as you move through your day, look for those detours. Notice the physical spaces that have been altered by the emotional earthquakes in your own home. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning how the world around you is constructed, and we will catch you next time.